funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have an author here who I've wanted to talk to for such a long time that I'm afraid of being overwhelmed by the number of things I want to talk to him about. But we're going to talk first about his new novel, Terrorist, which has been published by Alfred A. Knopf. It is what? The most recent of some 22 novels, 23.
22.
And, you know, those began with The Poorhouse Fair, Rabbit Run. I mean, unthinkable of a writer writing Rabbit Run as a second novel. The Centaur of the Farm, just to name them, is to name a real, well, they're all entries in the great American novels. Now, Terrorist begins, oh, yes, and I haven't mentioned his name. It's John Updike. I feel that the author of Rabbit Run doesn't even need naming, let alone introduction. And the new novel is Terrorist. Terrorist begins with its young, potentially suicide bomber character thinking, devils, these devils seek to take away my God. And it ends on a somewhat different note. He's learned something. He thinks, these devils have taken away my God. And I wanted to ask you, because what he fears at the beginning is not what he realizes at the end.
No?
It seems to me that the God that they've taken away his idea of what a God can be, and they've asked him to do what Updike characters are frequently asked to do. They're asking him to live in the face of a confusion about God rather than a certitude.
That sounds right. The book was meant to make the trip between those two sentences for him to discover through the various events and traumas and near misses and of the novel that, yes, they had, the devils had indeed succeeded in weakening his certitude. But his certitude, certitude in religious matters is a dangerous thing. As we can see, not just from the Islamic radicals, but even in the Christian right and any number of people, when you take it seriously or take it to the exclusion of the world that exists around us, I think it becomes potentially murderous and prohibitive and life-denying. And without talking too much about the way the book ends, since it is in a fashion a suspense novel and meant to excite the reader about the outcome. He does have a theological revelation to the effect that God is not a God of death, but a God of life.
Now, and yet, he shares with your heroes a sense of how life should be lived. Looking through a windshield at a bunch of people scantily clad, lazing around, he thinks they are lazy and they have no faith. And these qualities, industry and the ability to have faith, seem crucial to the kinds of people who interest you in the writing of a novel.
I suppose so, and I suppose in my fashion I've evinced industry and had a kind of faith. I began as a writer with the faith that I could do something artistic, that I didn't have to get a job like my father did. I didn't have to teach as he did. So I was propelled by a really unfounded faith into a career that, in fact, was somewhat drying up under me. But I didn't know that. That is the kind of respect that in this country went to writers, the kind of celebrity that they were awarded, the kind of way they were credited with wisdom.
As I read and reread these books, the questions of faith in them seem to me to be real, complicated, earnestly engaged, and it's not just a faith in the literary art. It's a faith in what faith does for a life, even as one steps away from it or turns one's back on it.
What it did for me is, insofar as I can look back and phrase it fairly, is released me from terror. The notion that you're going to die someday and that the stars will continue to twinkle and various crowds will continue to gather at the corner of 42nd and Broadway, and that life will go on, and but even the planet will eventually succumb. And now they have a pretty good handle on how the universe will wink out over billions of years. All that is potentially a huge abyss under your little animal life, your 70 years, more or less, that I felt myself paralyzed or potentially paralyzed. Waves of terror would sweep over me at intervals perhaps of 8 or 9 years at inconvenient moments, and nothing but the Christian faith seemed to offer a relief from these existential fears. And so I never let go of the Lutheran faith in which I was raised, although as a child I viewed it with some distaste and distrust. I didn't really like good people, but my father was one of them. He was a Sunday school teacher, and so it's meant a lot to me artistically because it enabled me to continue to be as creative as I could, to have fun with the creative arts. I used to draw too, and live. I can't imagine really, millions do it, but I find it hard to believe that without a faith in something bigger than you are and with some transcendent value to be assigned this mortal life, that people can really not be scared and depressed and terrified.
Now, Ahmed seems then, is that how you say his name?
People do who know Arabic. I tend to say Ahmad, but Ahmad sounds good to me.
He poses a paradox because he is a person of very harsh faith. And, you know, what seems to animate this novel is the recognition that in this case, industry and faith seem not to be a palliative for terror, but rather the precondition for an embrace of terror.
He doesn't have an artistic vocation as I did. He didn't have. He doesn't really seem to have anything on his mind except his faith. That may be a limit in him as a character, or me as the creator of this character. But in turning to Islam at a young age, 11, I believe, is when the novel assigns his decision to go to the mosque and receive teaching from the imam. He thinks about little else. This has been raised as an objection to him as a believable character, but there are touches of the other life. He is on the track team. He does respond to a flirtation from a fellow high schooler. He is, in an adolescent way, courteous to his mother. He is conscientious at his assignments. But yes, he is meant to be a highly religious young man. I don't think this is totally unrealistic. I think the young are often idealistic in some direction or another, and it takes the form, I've seen it, of fervent Christian activity. It's a time of life when you're sort of putting your chips down for the big gamble of the 50 years ahead, and he certainly has placed his chips on Allah and what is called repeatedly in the book the straight path. He wants to remain on the straight path, and the concept of purity, pure versus the impure, is prevalent in Semitic religions, both Judaism and Christianity to a lesser degree, and Islam emphasize keeping pure. So in the attempt to keep himself pure, not one of my concerns, I don't recall, keep himself pure, he doesn't have any clear vision of what he wants to do in life and is susceptible to the invitation to become a truck driver.
In the novel, there's a scene that I think is really very beautifully done and might be a secular American version of one of the Arabian Nights. The young man works in a furniture store. He's a truck driver for them. He's being prepared as a truck driver for a more desperate mission. And a prostitute is brought to him, and the place for this assignation is to be the upstairs of the store where the beds are. There are hundreds of beds around. It's almost as if his own reticence is given exaggeration by the number of beds that he has to choose from. And it's a kind of fabulous scene in which a dream come true is resisted, in a sense, and all kinds of novelistic opportunities are resisted by this character. And I wondered if you could describe the writing of a scene in which an Updike hero is only going to endure the pain of pressure against his body, nothing more.
The scene has been long anticipated in the course of the novel because his new father figure, Charlie Chahab, keeps worrying about the boys being a virgin. To him, this seems unnatural, and as a favor, he wants to arrange to have the boy devirginated, as the girl says. So it's a scene similar to many I've written in the course of my career as a novelist, and always with some pleasure, somehow describing sex between people is, while not 100% fresh at this day and age, it's still seems to me to be an attempt worth trying, an attempt worth making. The sex was so long left vague because everybody was assumed to know what that is, and maybe that was a good proper way to treat it. But I, among others, took it upon myself to try to describe this curious transaction between men and women, usually. And there's a certain if your search as a novelist is for those moments of intimacy that ring true in when the character is most themselves, sex and prayer, and certain sensations of bliss in just being alive, like Harry Angstrom and scoring a basketball, seeing the ball go up and through the ring and make the net jump. These are key moments in my iconography of life at its best. So yeah, sure. Then the furniture, the beds, the multitude of beds, the sort of a plateau, a prairie, really of beds, was part of the comedy of this encounter.
And he has to go down because the beds are covered with plastic, and bring up a rug to cover the bed with, because diligent young man, to remove the plastic, their sweat would soil the new mattress. He's respectful of the store owners, and so he brings up an oriental rug
right.
for them to roll about on and place on the mattress.
Which gives it that Arabian Nights flavor, perhaps, in part, that you mentioned. No, he is not only as a conscientious employee of the establishment, but as a good Muslim, he's wary of stains of impurity, of soiling anything. He does, in the end, soil himself a bit. But Joralene was quite real to me. And in her way, this is a tender moment for her, something she's trying to offer. And she gives him a few words of wisdom that actually, if he had listened to them, he might have avoided some later trouble. So she's a benign presence, although her own life doesn't look too happy at the moment, too happy in its eventual outcome. But he sees that, too. He sees her as a woman, a young woman giving her life, in a sense, for another, for her pimp whom she loves. So, yeah, it's meant to be. I'm glad you noticed the scene. In some ways, it's key, and his refusal to get involved in any continuing level, of course, further equips him for the mission that lies ahead.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Updike, author most recently of Terrorist, published by Knopf. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Updike about his novel Terrorist. Now, a complicated question. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, literary critics would say that a work of art defines its own boundaries and that a work needs to stay true within those boundaries. It would get a name like something complicated. I think the word autotelic occurs to me, but I don't remember who used it. Now a novel like Terrorist appears, and the novelist is being asked, essentially by critics, not to answer to his fictional world, but to the entire world of current events which the novel is an answer to. Now, a novelist, it seems to me, can only be responsible to his characters and his situations, but there seems to be a call for books to answer the whole enchilada, the whole political problem, that by bringing up the subject, one is raising one's hand and saying, I have an answer, and this inevitably is an insufficient answer.
Yes, and I don't have an answer to the problem of terrorism or of unease in the Middle East or the Palestine-Israel problem, which is one of the alleged flashpoints of the present hostile Islamic mood. I entered this book with the belief that I could animate from within a young man religious enough to be willing to be a suicide bomber. Again, I hate to trespass upon the actual developments of the book, but I guess it's not too much to say that I felt I could feel from within the religious wish to please God and to be on the right side. So that was really my only entry into the whole discussion. One reviewer complained that my portrait of Ahmad was not as persuasive as the portraits of the real suicide bombers who perpetrated the 9/11 disaster. And I read those with interest, of course. I did. I was a student of terrorists, I don't really feel any need to apologize for my terrorist, though he doesn't exactly match the psychological profiles of those. I mean, we are trying, in that case, to look at real men and their limited biographies and try to find the point that they became terrorists. And I think really you're either the moment at which one becomes a zealot is very hard to locate. The same circumstances can make a zealot of one man and a scoffer of another. So I rest my case within the bounds of the novel. I tried to make a persuasive and gripping vision of a modern instance of terrorism.
What I'm also interested in, you know, when Rabbit first came out, Mary McCarthy had the grace to say in her interview, I think in the Paris Review, that that reviewers seemed to be under the impression that the hero was a terrible character. It's incredible. She said, no, I think it's the most interesting American novel I've read in a long time. So going from a country that wanted to expel a character for being terrible or morally terrible or unlikable, we've gone to a country that wants to expel a writer for providing characters who go against the grain of expected pieties. Now, it seems to me that a writer to write an individual book would virtually have to, that the result of such demands would be, well, a universal novel, an or novel that you could put different names on. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that you've virtually enjoyed a level of provocation in this regard.
Both Rabbit Run and The Terrorist are, in a sense, provocative, yes, and they refuse to ring up the usual payoffs for what the readers consider sin or dereliction. My question in Rabbit Run was to say, you probably shouldn't desert your wife and infant child, but on the other hand, what do you owe the inner imperatives, the yearning for freedom, the yearning to be a better self or your real self? So, yes, he was considered to be quite an offensive character, and the novel made no moral sense to some readers because there wasn't a punishment handed out. But my whole idea was, no, the novel exists to provoke questions, not to reinforce societal standards, but to maybe tease them a bit, or tease them isn't maybe strong enough a word, to defy them, one might even say. So yeah, I'm an amiable guy who maybe is a little less amiable when he sits down at his desk and tries to imagine fictions. Fiction's duty is surely to direct our sympathies in new directions, and Rabbit was meant to be a new direction for the readers of the 1960. I guess it came out to ponder. It was a time when Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and so on were in the public consciousness. Abstract expressionism was considered an act of wild defiance of norms in visual art. So there was a lot of rebellion simmering under the surface, and it might even, my thought was, affect a ordinary young man in a middle American city of no great distinction. The brewer of Rabbit's World, by the way, is certainly a close cousin to the new prospect of Ahmad's world. These are places whose prime is past and whose factories stand as monuments to a vanished enterprise, to exhausted hopes.
Now, the phrase you used, I think, in the introduction to the Rabbit books was incorrigible rabbit facing his incorrigible God. But can you rephrase that for Ahmad?
He is corrigible. He is, he is corrigible in that he's willing to take instruction in the end. And having after a long run up the straight path, he sees it's not so straight, and so he's surrendered a bit of his faith, and surrendered. He's regained a bit of his own thought after living for years, really drifting along under the advice of the imam, who has his own agenda and something other than Ahmad's best interests at heart. So I don't know how I would. Rabbit seemed to me. He was based upon a number of athletic high schoolers whose later lives, as reported to me by my father, were anticlimactic. And the problem of the anticlimax, once youth is exhausted, is surely a deep-seated American problem. Still exists in different forms, but I was very aware of it in the 50s, the moment of the glory awarded to these young men then, and they weren't really good enough to go on and become the one in a 100,000 to become as a professional athlete. So what do they do with their lives? Ahmad thinks he knows what to do with his life, and then he finds his life is still on his hands at the end. Maybe he's not typical. Probably it's unusual to have so resolute a degree of faith, and I would be very willing to bow to my critics if I didn't see in the newspaper constant evidence that young men and women too, like Ahmad, exist. There's no shortage, incredibly, of volunteers to be suicide bombers.
I've been speaking with John Updike, author most recently of Terrorist, published by Knopf. We'll be back to talk about the Rabbit novels, which have just been chosen or voted or nominated to be among the best 5 novels written in the last 25 years. Thank you, John, for joining me.
Pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Terrorist on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com. And copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.